bungalows. The tipster said that Moses' slum clearance committee had agreed to purchase the tract for $1 million, although its present owners had recently purchased it for $500,000, thereby giving those owners a quick $500,000 profit before they even began to build the high-rent apartments that the committee had approved for the site. According to the tipster, the land was held in the name of a dummy owner, and it would be worth Gleason's while to find out who the real owner was. The deeds on file in the Bronx County Courthouse showed the owner to be a Miss Helen Nugent, who Gleason guessed at once was a secretary in some lawyer's office. But whose office? Who was Miss Nugent a dummy for? Who was making the $500,000 and the millions more that were to come? Gleason learned that her employer was the law firm of Goldwater and Flynn. Goldwater denied that he had any financial interest in the project, maintaining he was only the attorney for the real owners. But he refused to reveal their identity, and the telly's head, played above a picture of neat bungalows captioned, "This is a slum," noted that the mystery woman's boss was Dem Bigwig Goldwater, and under that head, Fred Cook, writing the hell out of the story, said that the Soundview deal represented a clear $500,000 windfall to political insiders. And soon he and other newspapers were noting that Ed Flynn's old partner was still a power in Bronx politics under Flynn's successor Charles Buckley, and that he and his son represented not only Soundview, but two other controversial Title I projects. Influence, Dem Bigwig, Tammany, Political Insiders, DeSapio, Buckley. The boss of Manhattan and the boss of the Bronx were somehow involved, deeply involved, in a Moses program. Following the trail left by those overlooked documents in Moses' files, the hard-riding reporters had come at last upon the secret that would destroy the heart of the Moses legend. The fact that this man, who supposedly scorned politicians, had allowed the top echelon of New York's politicians to reap fortunes from his Title I program. And they led their readers to the secret with stories that, linking Moses to politicians, were as accurate as earlier stories linking him to the underworld had been unfair. A letter to the Times showed that at least one reader was grasping the significance of these revelations. It was a letter such as had never before been printed about Robert Moses. "Robert Moses," the letter said, "is a boss like DeSapio himself." And of course, the deeper the reporters delved, the more there began to come into focus the shadowy figure of the man who formed the key connection between Moses and the machine, and the clearer that connection became. Haddad had been hearing about Shanahan for years, of course. During his earlier investigations into the building department and housing authority, he had learned that, as he puts it, the word was out that if you wanted to do any kind of work with the city, you had to put your money in Federation. I mean, it was no secret. Everyone you talked to seemed to know it. And hardly had a surly Moses aide dumped the first batch of slum clearance committee minutes in front of him when he noticed that the committee was taking many decisions on report and recommendation of vice chairman. Among these decisions, he noticed, were many of those on the selection of sponsors. What, he asked Liebwohl, was the vice chairman's role in the selection process? Well, Liebwohl replied, he qualifies them. And what, Haddad asked, did that mean? He uses his bank to check the financial responsibility of potential sponsors at no cost to the committee, Liebwohl replied. He determines who is the most qualified. And, Haddad asked, did the committee always accept Shanahan's recommendation? Usually, Liebwohl replied. The discerner of patterns saw the pattern then. Moses was up in the clouds as far as Title I was concerned, he says. He was the gray eminence. Shanahan was the administrative force. Gradually, we began to find out that Shanahan was making all the decisions. For weeks, however, the vice chairman's approval of the Pokras designation was the only newsworthy decision he and Kahn could directly lay at his door. Then, One day, one of the anonymous calls. You answer every one. You're always hoping that this is the one that will blow the whole thing open. Told Khan that one sponsor approved by Shanahan not only had deposited huge sums of money in Shanahan's bank, but had also, when he received his first commitment from the FHA for a $3 million loan, borrowed the money from Shanahan's bank, and was currently negotiating with the FHA for a $10 million loan, which he was also planning to make from Shanahan's bank. The caller told Khan that the FHA guarantee made these loans prime, risk-free business, on which the bank would make more than $1 million in interest, and that, since the guarantee applications had been made to the FHA, his tip could be verified. Getting the hint, Haddad went to the FHA and verified it, and began at last to break the Shanahan story. Shanahan flatly refused to talk to reporters, or to let them see any of Federation's records, but with the story breaking, Haddad's phone was hot with tips that Moses had deposited millions of Triborough funds in Shanahan's bank, that slumlord Unger's sponsorship had been approved by Shanahan after he offered to deposit $700,000, that Shanahan was a director of at least one Title I company. Checking these tips, Haddad found they checked out, and his stories identified Shanahan to the public not as the banker or philanthropist that newspapers had called him in the past, but in the role that made him important to Moses, a fundraiser and campaign treasurer for the Democratic Party, and a close friend of Tammany leader DeSapio. The band of eager young reporters was meeting at the corner table in Blake's Artists and Writers Bar almost every evening now. They had it down to a system. The only way to keep it going was to keep the papers goosing each other, Haddad would reminisce years later. If nobody picked it up, we were dead. So we'd leave a little piece out of a story and give that piece to Gene or Woody so they'd have a new lead, and they'd do the same for us. Sometimes I'd even give them carbons of my stories so they'd have it right in their desk. Their editor would say, "Check this out," and they'd have it right there. Each day now, they could see their strategy working. The Post, of course, had always played Title I revelations as they should be played. James Weschler helped you in the same way that a magazine editor or a book editor helps you. A real kind of involvement, of suggestion, of criticism, of rewriting, Haddad recalls. The editorial support, you couldn't ask for better placement in the paper. You couldn't ask for better editorials. As for Weschler's boss, there was constant pressure on Mrs. Schiff, Haddad would say, but she never buckled. Years later, he could still recall sitting with Khan in the city room one night, hour after hour, while upstairs, in Mrs. Schiff's office, she and Weschler were, the reporter knew, receiving telephone calls from her good friend Sam Rosenman and from other friends she respected, assailing her for printing their previous stories and asking her not to print any more, while in front of them was the story he had just written for the next day, even more hard-hitting than the previous stories had been, waiting for the decision on whether the paper would run it, and Weschler coming down finally and saying, "Just be sure you're thorough. We're not going to stop anything you write." And now, thanks to the Chipmunks' strategy, the editors of the World Telegram were, at last, enthusiastic too, even if their enthusiasm was based less on principle than on concern that they not be beaten by a competitor. Gleason and Cook and Woody Klein didn't have to sell editors on new material now. The editors were begging for it. Title I was page one now, not only in the Post but in the Telly, and more in the Journal American. First, they started picking up our stuff, and then Marty Stedman, a good, tough reporter, started developing some of his own. And one day, they had an 8-banner. They were in, too. We knew, to really break it open, the Times and the Trib had to start picking it up, Haddad says. Now Peter Braestrup rejoined Haddad, Gleason, Klein, and Stedman. Khan, too competitive to share, would never come, and Cook had no time, at the corner table. The Trib was in. Of all the factors that had kept Moses' popularity intact for 35 years, none was more important than the support of the newspaper whose principal stockholder felt, "There has never been as great a public servant." During the first months of 1959, despite all the Title I exposés by other papers, he had continued to enjoy that support. "There was a time," Cook would write, "when we could practically guarantee that any critical article of ours in the afternoon would bring a featured official denial in the New York Times in the morning." While the Times may not have been a crusading newspaper, however, it was a newspaper of record, proud of being the newspaper of record. And now, the records were open. Formal press conferences were being held, not only by the mayor, but by Monroe Goldwater and Sidney Unger. If the Times had wanted to ignore the Goldwater and Unger revelations, it would have been difficult for it to do so. After the Papp incident, moreover, there seemed to be less of a desire on the part of the paper's editors to do so. Charlie Grutzner, who had some years earlier been pulled off the housing beat because his articles angered Moses, was put back on it, and Wayne Phillips was assigned to an in-depth investigation. Haddad knew a new era was dawning when he picked up the Times on the morning of June 1, 1959, and read, on page 1, "The redevelopment plan proposed by Robert Moses for the Soundview Slum Clearance Project calls for the payment of nearly $400,000, sic, for land that the owners had offered for nothing." The entrance of the Times, with its ample space, immediately gave the Title I exposés a new dimension and depth. The daily running stories in the PMs averaged about 800 words. A four-part series that the Times began on June 26th ran 8,000, although the impression would later exist that that series had contained many new revelations, it contained hardly any that Haddad or Gleason hadn't uncovered before. All that had happened was that, by bringing them all together in a unified form, Phillips had shown the city the overall picture of its slum clearance program, and by doing so, had shown it in all its shocking dimensions. The entrance of the Times also gave the Title I exposés a new respectability, the cachet conferred by the newspaper's reputation for accuracy. Political officials suddenly became willing to comment. Stanley Isaacs and a young, movie star handsome congressman named John V. Lindsay had been assailing Moses' practices for months, but now politicians joined the parade in force, and each comment made a new article, kept the story rolling, kept momentum building. In every city room in New York now, the phones were, in Haddad's words, "jumping off the hook." Many of the tips coming over them were checking out into stories. "The thing was feeding on itself now, getting bigger and bigger," Kahn says. "It was the greatest time of my life." Haddad recalls, "We were making $140 a week, and it was just great." For months, years really, all the months and years in which the Title I exposés had been building up, it had been a young man's war, a guerrilla action carried out by what Kahn called newspapermen who weren't part of the newspaper establishment, and an action that had, moreover, been ridiculed by older, cynical, tired reporters. Haddad and Gleason first noticed the change when they stopped by Room 9, the City Hall press room. The older reporters were noticeably more friendly now. Then they became more helpful. Looking up from the Room 9 desk at which he was sitting one day, Haddad found one standing over him, waiting to fill him in on details of political alliances of New York. When Gleason had first been interrupting Wagner's staid, friendly, gentlemanly press conferences with embarrassing questions and refusing to let evasions go unchallenged, many of the older reporters had been openly hostile to him, believing he was disturbing their rapport with the mayor. Some of them going so far as to ask other questions on less controversial topics so as to change the subject. Now, when Gleason, joined by Haddad, began pressing the mayor for answers, there were no interruptions, and even some follow-up questions from the older men. Pressing particularly hard about Goldwater's conduct in Title I, Gleason roused Wagner to anger. "You can just get out of this room," he said. From the other reporters, there came a low murmur of disapproval. "You can't do that, Mayor," a voice said clearly. Gleason stayed. The next day, World Telegram City editor Norton Mockridge ordered up John Ferris's admiring story on Gleason, and the story included the line, "No one awes him." Haddad knew for sure that the times were changing in the city rooms on that long night when he sat waiting for hours for Mrs. Schiff's decision on whether to run the story he had written for the next day. He noticed that an elderly former photo editor, who had advanced to a more exalted editorship and now considered laying out pictures beneath him, was waiting around too, hours past his time to go home. Finally, Haddad asked him why he was staying. "Oh," the old newspaper man said embarrassedly, as offhand as if he did such things all the time, "I might as well stick around to do the picture layout on it, if it goes." Bigger and bigger now, the stories were also closer and closer to Robert Moses. Haddad and Kahn had noticed Donahue's name on the payrolls of Title I sponsors. Now they learned that it was also on the payroll of Moses' public authorities. Showing up on the payrolls of shady sponsors, they told the public, was Robert Moses' personal publicist. Many of the anonymous tips concerned Liebwohl, the Moses aide whose Moses-enriched relocation firm had hounded from their homes thousands of families in the way of the Cross Bronx Expressway and other Moses projects. "We had good information that Liebwohl was chummy with an architect close to Charlie Buckley, who had been given many Title I contracts," Kahn recalls. They interviewed him. "After we had hammered away at Liebwohl for about an hour, he finally admitted that he and the sponsor patronized the same health club. 'If you pass a man going across the gym, is that a crime?' he asked. 'I can't control the membership of a private health club.' 'But isn't it true that you eat with him later and he picks up the check?' Liebwohl was asked. 'Not all the time,' was the answer, the one we had been waiting for." Leaving Liebwohl's office, Kahn noticed that Haddad, usually so fiery and tough, looked pensive. Finally, the younger reporter asked him if he felt they should use the interview. "Why not?" Kahn said. "You're not suddenly getting soft, are you?"
"No, it's not that," Haddad said sadly. "It's just that all during the time you were throwing the questions, I couldn't take my eyes off the photograph of his wife and kids on the desk."
Kahn had noticed the photos himself, and he had known Liebwohl for a long time. "A reporter," he was to write, "is human, and he is moved by what he sees and hears as much as other people. But," he was to add, "in the end he must live with himself. I'm sorry," I told Bill. "I felt for the Liebwohl family as much as he did, but it had to be done." And it was. And Kahn's stories about Liebwohl identified him not as a city official, but as he should have been identified all along, Robert Moses' right arm. The circle of scandal was drawing closer around the man who had never been linked with scandal. And then it drew tighter still, with what Cook termed the first peep that has been obtained into the workings of the private consultant's role, one that Mr. Spargo frequently fills. Item by item now, the investigators were finding out about the supreme bloodhound, the man who always kept notes. That his salary as Triborough general manager was $40,000, as high as the mayor's. That in addition to that salary, he had received, on the recommendation of Mr. Robert Moses, $35,000 in consultants' fees from the Nassau County Bridge Authority, and, from Moses' own state power and Jones Beach authorities, a total of $243,000 in additional fees. That, while serving as director of the Slum Clearance Committee, he was a director of Shanahan's Federation Bank, which had made secret profits on slum clearance deals. Moses' identification with Liebwohl had gotten his name out of the back paragraphs of these scandal stories and into the leads.
his identification with Spargo got it into headlines. Headlines over profiles identifying Spargo as Mr. Moses' man. 8 banners in the telly and journal. Big screamers in the Post. Tie Moses' aid to bond fee. Fees paid to Moses' officials for bridge bonds. The $243,000 revelation put Moses' name in a story that reeked of scandal on the front page of the New York Times. Shanahan wasn't just a banker anymore. He was Moses' banker aide. After decades of building up an empire based on the raw material out of which newspapers produced scandal, Robert Moses' name was in 8 banners of scandal at last. He kept it there himself. Unable to endure even the hint of criticism, he simply could not ignore attacks aimed at his associates. He had to respond, and he did so almost frantically, trying to answer each charge, his messengers rushing replies marked for immediate release to newspaper offices, sometimes within an angry hour of the time those newspapers hit the stands. But response was a self-defeating tactic now. Its primary effect was to bring himself, hitherto only a figure behind the Shanahans, Spargos, and Leibowitz, front and center, thereby accomplishing what the reporters, despite all their efforts, had not previously been able to accomplish, to make himself, rather than them, the primary target. Moreover, to Moses, response meant attack. Since it was primarily the press making the charges he was opposing, he attacked the press. As usual, he attacked on all fronts. Haddad soon became aware that investigators were checking into his whole life history, trying, the reporter believed, to find some handle that could be used against him. Reporters were trying to cover the meetings of the Slum Clearance Committee in Triborough headquarters now. Moses saw to it that they were not told what time the meetings would be over, so they had to wait in the lobby downstairs. His guards would not permit them up to the second floor, where the meetings were held, for hours, so that they would not miss the participants emerging. Previously, reporters up at Randall's Island would be invited to the sumptuous lunches at which Moses would charm them. Now, not only were they not invited, but when Moses learned that, afraid to leave the island and travel all the way back to Manhattan for lunch, they had been making do with Cokes and candy bars from the vending machines in a corridor off the lobby, he had the door to the corridor locked. Wagner may have been bullied at his press conferences. Moses was not. The coordinator, fresh from his lunch, strode into the room in which reporters were waiting, hungry and thirsty, after 1 4-hour committee meeting. "He was," Gleason reported in a memo to his office, "licking his chops. Literally." Would it perhaps help if the reporters were allowed to see the committee's agenda so they could know what topics the committee had discussed? "No," Moses said. The reporters waited for him to say something else. He said nothing. Finally, the reporters began asking other questions. Gleason asked one in his bullying style. "Jesus, Moses seemed to tower when he came out of his seat," Haddad recalls. Moses had 2 words for Gleason. "Get out." The other reporters tried the technique that had worked with Wagner, saying unless Gleason stayed, they would all go. Without another word, Moses rose and strode from the room. The press conference was over. Moses' main fire was directed over reporters' heads, of course. Triborough's messengers were deluging publishers and their top editors with personal complaints. Moses was soon taking the fight to the press on a dozen different fronts. But fighting the press is a battle that no public official can win, for the battleground is not just of the press's choosing, it is the press. His attacks would be played as the media wanted them played. Moreover, attacking a particular newspaper, and because the articles were to a great extent exposés that were breaking in one paper at a time, his attacks were often against a specific newspaper, was practically the surest guarantee that that newspaper would attack him again in its turn. The story that had enraged Moses may have been written by an individual reporter, But it was not the reporter alone who would have to bear responsibility for it and defend it to the publisher or chief editor. Lower-ranking editors, with stories of such significance, editors on several levels, would have had to approve it. Therefore, when Moses attacked a newspaper publicly or in a private letter to its publisher, a lot of people on that newspaper had to justify themselves. And the most effective method of justification was to find other things wrong with the Title I program and to write more stories. Many key newspaper men in New York had previously had a vested interest in preserving Moses' image. Now many of these same journalists had a vested interest in destroying it. What was needed was discreet silence and wait until the storm was over. And silence was one commodity it had never been within Moses' power to deliver. The self-defeating nature of Moses' tactics was demonstrated in developments on the Times front. Even after Grutzer and Phillips had begun breaking and receiving good play on Title I revelations, the paper's attitude toward its longtime hero was decidedly schizophrenic. Moses attacked the reporters personally. To one Phillips piece, he replied on June 22nd, "The Times reporter is either very befuddled or deliberately malicious." And the Times' handling of his replies embittered other reporters, one of whom, Gay Talese, was to write in his history of the paper, "His letters of objection did not appear in the letters to the editor space, where they belonged. Instead, they were published on various days within the news columns as news, being prefaced by an explanatory paragraph, appearing under a news headline, and being given immediate and serious play. This not only raised readers' doubts about the credibility of the series, but it also took some of the edge off the series, which the reporter had carefully researched for months, and which was accurate and objective, if not totally satisfactory to Moses in all of its detail and interpretation." When, on June 25th, Moses used his familiar resignation gambit on Wagner, the Times' editorial response was its traditional one. "Our confidence in Mr. Moses as an honest, incomparably able public servant is unshaken. His resignation from any office would be an irreparable loss. Where is his equal?" But as Moses continued to attack, criticizing even straight-running news stories on breaking developments, the Times' ardor began almost visibly to cool. When Grutzner helped break the Giganti story, Moses replied, "This is one of those startling disclosures promised by the Times over the radio in the morning to solicit new readers." Grutzner's City Room editors responded by okaying his submission of a list of written questions to Moses. Moses tried to go over their heads. "I immediately protested to Orville Dreyfus, president of the Times, about innuendos in those questions," he says. The result, in Moses' own words, "In spite of a placating reply by managing editor Turner Catledge, the Times continued in this vein, printing slanted, inaccurate, and misleading stories. A reporter needled a federal housing official into declaring that prior approval of the Bellevue South project had not been obtained. I wrote to Dreyfus again, pointing out that this is not the kind of journalism we have been led to expect from a great newspaper. Additional reporters were assigned, and I was soon presented with the fruit of their labor, a new questionnaire of the kind ordinarily addressed to Appalachian thugs, dope peddlers, etc. Since, as I wrote Dreyfus, they were directed only at baiting me in the hope that your staff can cash in on some more sensationalism, I decided not to answer them." He tried to go over everyone's head, reporters, editors, presidents. In July, following an incident that occurred during a vacation, an incident that, were he susceptible to humiliation, would have been deeply humiliating. He described it in a letter to his old and close friend Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, the Times publisher. "Yesterday afternoon, following a series of similar phone calls from the Times addressed directly and indirectly to officials in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, a reporter from El Mundo interrupted Mary and me at the San Juan airport to ask grossly insulting questions. one of which was what I had to say about relations with the underworld in connection with Title I housing in New York. I was able to glance at some of the questions on a yellow sheet, which this reporter said were telephoned from the Times. The word underworld was definitely and unmistakably on this sheet. There were several people around who heard this. Officials in the area told me of similar phone questions aimed to embarrass me. Fortunately, the only effect of these questions on the people who invited me down was to lower the prestige of the Times. This response worked for a while. Sulzberger apologized, and shortly thereafter invited Moses, as he did every summer, to visit Iphigenia and himself at their country home. "A lot of water has gone under the bridge," the publisher wrote, "but I hope it hasn't washed the bridge away." "The bridge is pretty damn rickety, what with the flood of abuse and bilge we have been subjected to, but we shall drop in," Moses replied. For some weeks thereafter, the Times Title I play, while substantial, appeared considerably toned down. But what he had done could no longer be undone. The Times' coverage of Title I had been balanced on a razor's edge. His efforts had tipped the balance, against himself. As the revelations in other papers continued, the Times began to pick them up again, and to play them bigger and bigger. Not only Phillips and Grutzner, but their immediate superiors, and some not so immediate, were now in the same boat as their counterparts on the Herald Tribune and the Journal American and the World Telegram. Once they had had a vested interest in building Moses up, now they had one in tearing him down, in finding new material that would support earlier articles. If new material was to be available to these newspapers now, they would do their best to join the Post in giving it proper play. And as the telephone tips and the anonymous letters and the public statements and the federal and city audits poured in to all these different city rooms, these reporters and editors had all the material they needed. They were not chipping away any longer at the towering Moses image. They were chopping away at it, with great roundhouse swings of the media axe, chopping away day after day, week after week, month after month. First, it had been Moses' programs that had been under attack. Then it had been his aides. And now, finally, it was he himself. "The great statesman McKee is a synthetic character which never actually existed on sea or land, puffed up by the press, and now in the process of deflation," Robert Moses had written once. "There is a large amount of unfairness to the individual in this process, but in the end it arrives at the truth." His observation had been accurate, and it was never better proven than by his own case. The incorruptible, uncorrupting, apolitical, utterly selfless public servant Moses had been a synthetic character, largely puffed up by the press. That character had endured for 35 years. But in 1959, the process of deflation by the press, a process that had been going on intermittently for several years, had begun in earnest. In that process, there had been a large amount of unfairness. But that process had, in the end, arrived at the truth. At the beginning of 1959, the Moses image had stood in most of its glory, intact except for a few small chips. At the end of 1959, it lay in unsalvageable ruins. Popularity, Al Smith had warned him, was a slender reed. Now the reed was broken. But popularity was no longer a significant factor in Moses' power equation. His power rested not on a reed, but on a rock. Unaware of the full extent of the power of the public authority, the press did not understand this. It assumed that he could be fired or forced to resign like any other mayoral appointee. But Wagner couldn't do that. Personality made it difficult, both because of the mayor's respect for men of his father's generation. "You don't fire your father," he was to tell a young anti-Moses aide, Tim Cooney. "Never forget that, Tim. You don't fire your father." And because of other Wagnerian traits. Paul Scrivain, asked if the mayor might not have done it, just laughs. "Do you know Wagner?" he says. "Wagner never fired anyone in his life unless the fellow was convicted of a crime, and when you think of him firing a giant like Moses, it's just inconceivable. Moses might have been a thorn in his side. Wagner may have wanted him out. He may have wanted to get the press off his neck, but Wagner would never have fired Moses." Politics made it impossible. Whether or not the calmly canny mayor was already contemplating snatching the reins of party power out of DeSapio's hands, or whether he was only concerned with keeping Tammany's horses in line, he needed what Moses, and to a large extent Moses alone, could give him. The contracts and fees, on which lived the machine and the other economic forces, banks, unions, which conferred political power in New York. In 1959, this provender was stacked higher than ever in the larders of Moses' authorities. With $92 million worth of contracts for the Throgs Neck Bridge about to be let, $345 million worth of bond issues for the Verrazano Narrows Bridge firmed up and ready to be sold, and $100 million worth of new bridge-connecting expressways ready to be approved as soon as Moses gave the word to the federal highway officials under his thumb, the mayor had half a billion reasons to keep him friendly. Firing Moses would cut his, the mayor's, tie to the source of funds which kept men loyal to a mayor. And to such men, no rationale would excuse such an action. What was he supposed to do? Tell Pete Brennan and Van Arsdale that, because of a little heat from the press, they would have to get along without $100 million worth of expressway jobs? Firing Moses would not, moreover, remove Moses from power. Far from it. Moses' power was largely beyond a mayor's reach. Wagner could fire him as slum clearance committee chairman, park commissioner, and construction coordinator. He couldn't fire him from his five state posts, which gave Moses so much power in a city dependent on Albany, or from his tri-borough authority chairmanship, which gave him so much of his money. He had handed Moses a fresh 6-year term just a year before. Moses would still have those posts, no matter what Wagner did. He dared not even antagonize Moses, lest Moses, in anger, throw his money and power on the side of the mayor's enemies. He could not risk hinting, even in private, that he might not object if Moses resigned just one, the Slum Clearance Committee chairmanship, of his many posts, lest the hint ignite Moses' always smoldering anger. Despite innumerable provocations, Wagner, in dealing with Moses, had been swallowing his pride for years. He would have to go on swallowing it. Had the press access to records more revealing than those of the Slum Clearance Committee, Triborough's records, they might have understood this. It would have been difficult not to had they known that the whole Democratic machine, the leaders of all five county organizations on which Wagner depended, were on Moses' payroll, and that they were all in line for pay boosts. That not only Shanahan, and through Shanahan, DeSapio, the Manhattan leader, but Steingut, the Brooklyn leader, and Rowe, the Queens leader, and Buckley, the Bronx leader, had, in one form of fee or contract or another, made money out of Triborough's projects in the past and were expecting to make more money out of Triborough's projects in the future. Even without those records, there were plenty of symbols around that should have made the press understand the extent to which Wagner's power rested on Moses' money. The two men involved in the Title I picture were Shanahan and Goldwater. Were Shanahan and Goldwater friends of Moses only? Hardly. They were friends also of Wagner's. In his last three campaigns for public office, they had been his two key fundraisers. In the case of Shanahan, the press had discovered a fact even more blatantly symbolic. It was not just Moses who had been depositing huge sums in Shanahan's bank. Wagner had too. But the press, without access to Triborough's records or understanding of Triborough's power, portrayed to the public a misleading picture of ensuing developments. In part two, the press's misunderstanding was merely the wish's predilection to be the father to the thought. Having exposed wrongdoing, the crusading reporters wanted it stopped, stopped, moreover, by some official action that would have the effect of placing the imprimatur of official verification on the revelations they had made. While editorial writers demanded action, reporters kept asking Wagner what action he was planning to take. Wagner had no choice but to say he was certainly going to take some, but he kept his statements as low-key and vague as possible, and, when pressed for specifics, never gave any. All the mayor was doing was trying to ride out the storm. He had no intention of doing anything that might arouse Moses' ire. But the press read into Wagner's remarks hints that action was imminent, and when none occurred, they misinterpreted the reason, portraying for their readers a mayor who wanted Moses out, but was constantly, and inexplicably, being faced down by him. They portrayed conflict where none existed, created a drama of confrontation between two men who were actually conspirators. The depth of the misunderstanding was shown in a remark by one of them. "You could only push Bob Wagner so far. When it came to protection of the political body, he could be very tough indeed, and protection of the political body was what it had come to here." This observer was right about Wagner's toughness, but wrong about what it required. He thought protection of the mayor's political body required Moses to go. Actually, it required him to stay. There was never any real chance that Wagner would force Moses out, as, years after the fact, himself long retired from office, he told the author quite frankly, although he was less frank about the reasons. After circling warily about the issue for hours, finally obviously weary of answering the same questions over and over, Wagner said in exasperation, "Look, I didn't push it. Never in any way did I ever induce anyone to intercede with him or to hint to him that he should resign. And I never would have." Wagner would probably have liked Moses to resign, so long as he did so on a friendly basis. But if Moses didn't want to go, he would not have had to. Reading what they wanted into Wagner's every innocuous remark, reporters continually assured their readers that the mayor was going to crack down on Moses, pull up the reins, cut his power, and therefore the reporters, and those readers who wanted Moses' power cut, were to be repeatedly disappointed. Misunderstanding and consequent disappointment can be read clearly between the lines of the Cook-Gleason recapitulation in The Shame of New York, of the events that followed their Soundview revelations. The mayor authorized a deputy to tell the press that the Soundview project was as good as dead. It had been up before the Board of Estimate, and the board hadn't liked the looks of that $500,000 markup in land value. The mayor was positive that the board wouldn't think any better of it now. Taking the mayor at his word, residents in the bungalow colony danced in the streets that night, a celebration that, as the sequel was to show, was decidedly premature. For, though Mayor Wagner had begun to announce, in his City Hall press conferences, that "I am the mayor," there is now rather abundant evidence that the statement isn't to be taken as literally as the late Frank Haig's "I am the law." The project may have been dead in the mind of Robert "I am the mayor" Wagner, but it definitely wasn't dead in the mind of Robert "the great doer" Moses. A few weeks after the mayor had announced Soundview's demise, Moses gave out a list of 8 projects for which he wanted the City Planning Commission to put up $10 million for advance planning. The list included Soundview. Moses was questioned at once. Wasn't Soundview, on the mayor's own admission, supposed to be dead? The reply, "You can bet your life it's alive." And so it proved to be. Checking quietly with the mayor to find out if he wanted the project or not, HHFA Administrator Freed was told flatly that he did. The showdowns, repeatedly predicted by the press, somehow never occurred. Once, anti-Moses Wagner aides, desperate to force the mayor's hand, leaked a Moses resignation ultimatum. "Moses ready to quit," the headlines read. "Mayor weighs full inquiry." At his next press conference, Wagner tried to laugh off the threat. Pressed to the wall, he finally said he would have a long talk with Moses at the Messina opening the next day. Would he give Moses' resignation offer serious consideration? A reporter asked. Certainly, the mayor said. Wagner and Moses will confer on Title I disclosures today, the Times headlined, telling its readers that the talk may affect the administration of New York City's slum clearance. Actual developments at Messina hardly merited headlines, however. Moses took the mayor's wife and two sons to meet Queen Elizabeth. The Moseses and Wagners had dinner together. The next day, the two men toured the Robert Moses Power Dam and then went for a swim together. On Wagner's return to the city, he said blandly that Moses had given no indication that he wanted to resign. What about the serious consideration? Wagner replied with a single sentence. Bob Moses is a good public servant. Had the two men really discussed Title I at all? Wagner said they had, but when asked about the discussion, replied, nothing specific. When Moses said that the controversy about Title I had made the program a dead duck in New York, Citizens Union, City Club, and a dozen editorials demanded Wagner fire him. It is no longer a question whether anyone should be asked to resign, a Citizens Union statement said. There was no sense having a vital program headed by someone who didn't believe it could accomplish anything more. Reporters told their readers that there was a serious possibility that Moses might leave, that officials around City Hall were already speculating on who will take his place. Wagner said he was sure Moses wasn't serious. Of course, Title I had a great future in New York. Moses, informed of Wagner's statement by reporters, said, I don't care what the mayor says. I still say Title I is a dead duck. Shanahan issued a statement agreeing with Moses. Publicly humiliated, Wagner displayed an anger new to reporters. Face flushed, pounding his desk, the mayor said, If people can't implement the policies of this administration, they have lost their usefulness. If they feel Title I is a dead duck, then they can't be helpful. I'm the mayor, and I will not have anyone on any committee if they cannot be helpful. I'm going to stop a lot of this nonsense. The mayor indicated he might put an axe to both Moses and Shanahan, the Daily News reported. But the news summed up Wagner's next press conference in the headline, Fire Moses, Wagner Ducks. A single incident should have illuminated the true nature of the relationship among Moses, Shanahan, and Wagner. After a new series of revelations about the banker's manipulations, the mayor had his press secretary tell reporters that he was spending the day at his summer home in Islip, but was certainly dissatisfied with Shanahan and would question him personally as soon as possible. Returning to City Hall the next day, Wagner implied that he had not yet spoken with the vice chairman. But reporters discovered that Wagner had not really been spending the previous day at his home, but at the Deepdale Golf Club in Manhasset, golfing and having a long, convivial dinner with Shanahan. Even after this discovery, however, the press kept playing events as if Wagner really wanted Moses to resign. Press coverage was misleading in its interpretation not only of Wagner's attitude, but of Moses. It portrayed the mayor as wanting to get rid of Moses as head of Title I, and that portrayal was false. But it also portrayed Moses as wanting to remain as head of Title I, and that portrayal was also false. Acting as intermediary between the two men, Deputy Mayor Paul O'Keefe was speaking to Moses frequently now, and he was suddenly startled, he recalls, to find himself with the clear impression that, despite the fact that Moses had never said anything directly, the housing job wasn't life and death to him. Months earlier, two very astute judges of human nature had come to an even stronger conclusion. Moses called a meeting when all the shit was hitting the fan, Peter J. Brennan says. Van and I went up to the island. On the surface, the meeting was one of Moses' customary mobilization of forces lunches. Jack Strauss of Macy's was there, and a lot of other guys who counted, Brennan says. Moses indicated that too many crybabies were being listened to, and he reviewed his program to show he was doing it right. Over dessert, Brennan recalls, he indicated that if there wasn't the proper kind of support, he wanted out. The two labor leaders grinned at the familiar Moses ultimatum, but, reviewing during their return trip downtown other statements Moses had made during lunch, they came to a startling conclusion. This time he really meant it. He wanted out. They were right. For the first time in his life, Robert Moses was willing to surrender some of his power. Moses would never, of course, have allowed himself to be forced out under fire. But during the summer of 1959, a graceful exit had materialized, the proposed New York World's Fair. The World's Fair presidency held several attractions. Some were personal, poignantly personal. His daughter Jane had cancer. She needed two major operations and long, expensive recuperative periods. The circumstances of her divorce had, moreover, left partly on her father the burden of her support. Jane's daughter, Caroline, had reached college age as a brilliant, arrogant girl in whom he saw much resemblance to himself. His granddaughter must have the best schooling, and tuition costs were rising, and after college he wanted her to go to Oxford as he had gone. Jane's son, Christopher, would be ready for college soon. And now Mary's arteriosclerosis and arthritis had advanced to a point where the 74-year-old woman was increasingly unable to care for herself. Doctors told Moses that she must either be placed in a nursing home or given around-the-clock nursing care. It was a depressed Robert Moses, as depressed as Sid Shapiro had ever seen him, who told his loyal aide one day that such care, combined with the cost of the extensive medication his wife would require for the rest of her life, would cost $24,000 a year. To meet these harrowing bills, Robert Moses had, in cash reserves, practically nothing. For all the years of his adult life, he had been short of money. During the last 5 years, for the first time, his salary from his numerous public offices had risen above a pittance, with his pay as park commissioner having been raised to $25,000 and his appointment as state power authority chairman giving him an additional $10,000 annually. After taxes, however, the $35,000 total shrunk to about $22,000, little enough for a man maintaining an apartment on expensive Gracie Terrace as well as a summer home in Babylon, especially when combined with the Moses prodigality with money and with his absolute refusal to leave himself open by using his expense accounts for personal needs to the type of pressure he exerted on others. That prodigality had exhausted most of his inheritance, and even that relatively small portion of the $100,000 consultant's fees from other cities that he had kept for himself. 71 years old, Robert Moses, the Robert Moses whom the press persisted in describing as independently wealthy, was, so far as cash was concerned, all but penniless. Accepting the World's Fair presidency would change that. The Rockefellers were prepared to participate in the fair quite actively, and in preliminary discussions with his counsel, Samuel Rosenman, the salary of $100,000 per year plus $10,000 in expenses had been mentioned, as had a 7-year contract. The contract finally worked out between Moses and the Fair Corporation gave him $75,000 per year plus $25,000 per year in expenses for 7 years, mid-1960 through mid-1967, and thereafter an annuity of $27,500 per year for an additional 7 years, 1967 through 1974. The money to guarantee the payment of this sum, a total of $892,500, was to be taken off the top of the Fair Corporation's receipts and placed in a special escrow account. Smaller, but still lucrative, salary and annuity arrangements were made for many Moses men. He would, at a stroke, be assured of freedom from the financial problems with which he had been living for so long. Some of the fair's attractions were philosophical. Try as he might to get away from that fact by using urban renewal funds for universities and cultural centers, Title I meant primarily housing, and housing had never engaged his enthusiasm as had parks and highways, which may have been why he had delegated it so completely to someone else. It was a cluttered, complicated field, one in which the grand conceptions of which he was capable never emerged as cleanly as in the uncluttered beauty of a bridge or beach. But, as always with Robert Moses, neither personal finances nor philosophy, but power and reputation, were apparently the determining factors. Although he never spelled out his feelings in detail, even to his top subordinates, he did drop enough hints to show them at least vague outlines of his thinking. In his view, and as always where power was concerned, his view was to prove perceptive, soon there wasn't going to be that much power in Title I in New York anymore. He had meant what he said when he called the city's program a dead duck. HHFA officials had been trying for years to slash drastically the city's disproportionate share of funds. Now, with his reputation so badly smeared, he believed they would do so with a vengeance. What new projects were built, moreover, would be built by genuine real estate builders like Zeckendorf, not by the type of promoters whose projects could give him political power. There was going to be power in the World's Fair, immense power. Sitting in on preliminary meetings of the Fair Committee, he had seen that fair spending, for pavilions, for example, would be on a national and international scale. To ease access to Flushing Meadows Park, he had determined that the fair was going to be held in that park, a vast network of new Queens highways, $120 million worth of new highways, would be needed. As his keen eye for power had seen in 1945 that housing was the field to enter, now it saw that the World's Fair was the field to enter. The fairgrounds were going to be the prime locale of power in New York. He could not keep his Title I job and take the fair job. He could not, in fact, keep any of his formal city jobs. The city's code of ethics was quite specific about that. The spectacle of a paid official simultaneously holding a paid job with a private corporation might be too grotesque to surmount, even for his oft-proven ability to get laws or codes changed, and he was not in as strong a position as he had been in the past to get laws changed. But there was little power in his formal city jobs anyway. Power was not derived from a park commissionership, whose annual budget was so small that no new park development of any real size could even be contemplated. It certainly was not derived from his membership on the City Planning Commission, which he no longer dominated. His informal city job as construction coordinator, in which he measured his resources in tens of millions of dollars, gave him power, but, thanks to the vagueness with which that job was defined, he had thought of a way in which he could keep that job. Power was derived from his Triborough Authority job, in which he measured his resources in hundreds of millions of dollars. He would be able to take the fair job and still keep that. Power was derived from his chairmanship of the State Power Authority, in which his resources were also measured in the hundreds of millions, and he could take the fair job and still keep that, as well as his other state posts, the Long Island State Park Commission presidency, the Jones Beach and Bethpage State Park Authorities, and State Council of Parks chairmanships. His appetite for power was undiminished. Shortly, he would be seeking to take over the development of atomic energy in the state, because he saw that this was the new field into which money might be poured. His method would be the advocacy of laws placing all such development under his state power authority. But by trading in his city jobs for the fair presidency, he would be giving that appetite more, not less, on which to feed. As for his precious reputation, Title I was wrecking it, and would continue to wreck it as long as he stayed connected with that operation. Unjustified though it may have been, there had been too much scandal attached to it. There was always going to be massive relocation involved, and the media's bleeding hearts made anyone in charge of massive relocation look bad. The World's Fair would be a chance to start in a new field with a clean slate, in a field which needed no clearing, for there wasn't a single protesting tenant in all Flushing Meadows' 1,400 acres. The meadows were a blank slate, almost as rasa a tabula as Jones Beach had been. Jones Beach, that had brought him glory. The fair was, moreover, a chance to write something glamorous, spectacular on that slate. for how could a World's Fair not be glamorous and spectacular? Even that incompetent clothes horse Grover Whalen had reaped wonderful publicity before his mismanagement had turned the 1939 fair into a source of ridicule. There would be no mismanagement under him. The fair would give his name back all its old luster. With its intonations of international amity and goodwill, it was a